From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, why Ingham County reported twice as many COVID cases at Michigan State as MSU officials reported.
There was a comment about, but we can't verify that they're students. It's like, I'm telling you that they're students.
Also, a curator who left the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit over equity issues talks about why she's coming back.
I think that if there's one thing to be said, it's that people in Detroit care about MOCAD and want MOCAD to be a place with best practices.
And some history from Hamtramck through the lens of the city's historic Negro League ballpark.
Black people could own houses, and most of the city of Detroit, black people could not buy a house. It was a pretty good place and a pretty accommodating place for African Americans. It was one of the reasons the ballpark was put there.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, Hamtramck's historic ballpark, built for the Negro Leagues, but deeply tied to the history of the entire city.
It had church leagues, it had concerts, it had war bond rallies during World War II. It was an amazing place.
That's coming up later on today's show. But first, it's no secret that Michigan's colleges and universities are struggling to get a handle on COVID infections this fall. Grand Valley State, Central Michigan, many schools have made the headlines for COVID outbreaks. Now, it looks like Michigan State University actually knowingly underreported the number of cases there, leaving out hundreds of confirmed cases among students and faculty and staff. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been looking into it and is here to break it down for us. Kate, hi.
Hey, April.
So you and the digital team were looking at COVID rates in Ingham County. That's obviously where Michigan State is located. First of all, we should probably review who is reporting what. Michigan State has a dashboard that it says is tracking cases. Do we know exactly what those numbers are based on?
Yeah, so we thought that we did up until now. You know, these dashboards, lots of schools have them. It's sort of a place where parents or community members or even just students are sort of going to try and get a sense of what things look like on the ground. And if you go to MSU's dashboard today, at this moment, when I'm looking at it, you're going to see that it says 548 known cases since July 27th. And then if you're like you just asked, what do those numbers include? There's a little note at the bottom that says those numbers reflect only those who have been tested and self-reported to the university, or those who the university becomes aware of through campus testing sites or local health departments. So it will not include all cases connected to the MSU community. And I mean, that seems straightforward. When I read it, you know, I assumed, okay, this is the number that is what the health department is telling them about, at least among students, faculty, and staff. And maybe it's not going to include every single other person in the broader community.
That sounds pretty straightforward.
No, yeah, completely. That's what I was going to say, is that when I read it, I assumed, okay, this is all the cases the health department is telling MSU about, at least among, you know, students, faculty, and staff, although maybe it's not including like every single person in the broader community.
So at the same time, the Ingham County Health Department is tracking cases. Kate, do you know if they consider university students who may not be permanent residents a part of their count?
Yes, they do, because anybody who tests positive for COVID in Ingham County, you know, even if they only live there during the school year, if their testing is positive there, the Ingham County Health Department is going to want to know about it. They're going to want to reach out, figure out who these people are, make sure they know how to isolate themselves, do contact tracing. So it doesn't matter to Ingham County if you live here just during the school year. You're here now and they want to talk to you and say, are you a student? Are you a staff member? Figure out who you've been in contact with.
Got it. So when did you notice a discrepancy between what MSU had for the number and what Ingham County had for the number?
Well, so the funny thing is that it's not like we like discovered these in like some secret documents or anything. This was just a press conference that the Ingham County Health Department has pretty regularly. This was yesterday's. And Linda Vail, the Ingham County Health Director, she mentions, you know, when she's reporting sort of where their numbers stand, she's like, oh yeah, with MSU-related numbers, we're at about 1,200 cases in the last month. And by the way, you know, when I asked about it, she said, yeah, you know, we've been telling MSU, hey, our numbers are way higher than yours. And we're pretty sure that our numbers are accurate.
That is, I think, is where the university is a little confused right now. We are the public health system. We do contact tracing. We do investigations. We are talking to students on the phone that say, I'm an MSU student. I'm an MSU student. I'm an MSU student.
So Kate, what wasn't MSU counting with its lower numbers?
Well, that was the big question, right? Because they're saying it's 548 cases. Linda Vail is saying it's 1,200 cases. And we asked Vail about that. And she says the pushback that she's gotten from MSU when she's saying, here are my case numbers, is that MSU wants to validate those cases independently to make sure that they're students and staff and to make sure that they're not already duplicated in the count that MSU has going. The problem, though, is that, you know, for patient privacy reasons, Vail says it's not like she can just send over a list of names of people who've tested positive unless there's a valid public health reason for disclosing that. Like if the health department couldn't track down a student.
It is not to be disclosed to them just so that we can compare our numbers. So, yes, there might be duplicates. My suggestion was then maybe you should just take our numbers because ours are probably more accurate. There was a comment about, but we can't verify that they're students. It's like, I'm telling you that they're students.
So what exactly was MSU's response to all this?
Yeah. So, you know, yesterday this press conference is in the afternoon and I'm listening to it and like my mouth is literally open here. And I shoot off an email to the spokesman for MSU, Dan Olson, saying, you know, hey, this is what the health department is saying. Is this 1,200 case number accurate? And did MSU know about it? And he called me right back right away. And he basically said, yes.
Obviously, it is apparent that Ingham County has a more robust number and information available to them. So we definitely don't dispute that number. But what we are able to do is take the information that they do share with us and try to attempt to verify that information so that we can include it in our dashboard as well. Some challenges with that is, you know, the information that is shared with the university. Sometimes it makes it a little bit difficult if numbers are shared with the university, but we don't have names associated with that. So it's harder to identify, you know, whether that number is attached to a student and that we're not duplicating that in our dashboard.
Again, that's Dan Olson, spokesman for Michigan State University. Okay, Kate, so if MSU does not doubt the county's numbers, if they think that they're right, that the case counts are actually twice what MSU is reporting, then why not just do what Linda Vail at the county said and use her numbers so that at least parents and students might have a clearer picture of what's going on?
Right. That is what I asked Dan Olson, you know, even if MSU can't independently verify what the health department is telling them, why not even just, you know, put something on the dashboard that shows the more accurate numbers and says, hey, this is what Ingham County is telling us. And Olson told me that they are looking into that's a possibility, that, you know, this dashboard is an evolving tool that's getting updated all the time. Vail, though, mentioned, you know, it says on that dashboard right now that this includes public health department cases, and she wants them in the meantime to at least like remove that line so that it's not misleading to people.
Is there any way for us to know whether this is happening in some other counties with colleges or universities or other big institutions?
So if the question is, are other colleges and big institutions undercounting their cases? The answer is almost certainly yes, but it's not necessarily for transparency issues. And it's not necessarily, you know, in a situation like this where the health department is saying, hey, we have way more case numbers. There is no, like, this is such a mess, April. We have been looking at these numbers and you cannot compare colleges apples to apples right now. There's no broad requirement about what any institution has to put up publicly in terms of the number of tests it's doing or the, you know, whether they say, you know, here's how many active cases we have, meaning cases they think are still infectious as opposed to total cases, or whether you have to count off-campus students. And without more requirements from the state, you know, we just don't know what we don't know.
Right. Now, here's my question. The spike around MSU is definitely of concern, but I mean, I believe Michigan State had already taken almost all of its classes online. Does the revelation of these new numbers mean anything new in terms of infection control? I mean, what else could they do at this point?
So that is what MSU and the health department are trying to figure out right now, because these case numbers are so high. And Linda Vail, the health officer, will say, you know, she doesn't think that this is because MSU sort of announced at the last minute that they were going to go online. She feels like these students would be here. They'd find off-campus housing no matter what. But she feels like she's running out of tools. You know, they've already put restrictions around the size of social gatherings. They've done mandated quarantines for, I think it's like 39 large student houses now, a lot of them sororities and fraternities. You know, she's looking over at Grand Valley State University, which currently has a stay-at-home order for students. She would like to avoid doing that because they just get really complicated really fast. You know, Grand Valley has like exceptions for if you have to go to class or you have to go to sports practice or you have to get food. And it's just really hard to do that with a big research school like MSU. But she'll say, you know, we're running out of tools here, and I don't think they know what they're going to do next.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. You can read the article that she and other members of the Michigan Radio team worked on online right now at michiganradio.org. Kate, thank you so much for digging through this for us.
Thanks, April.
We know there are a lot of college students and parents of college kids out there who are thinking hard about how COVID is affecting higher education and campus life. If you're one of them, we'd love to hear from you. Are you a student who's frustrated with your peers or with the way the school has handled pandemic life? Are you a parent who's had to make some hard decisions, possibly expensive decisions, about what college is going to look like for your son or daughter? Drop us a line, stateside@michiganradio.org. A curator who left the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit talks about working at the overwhelmingly white spaces in the art world.
Often alone, often being the only person of color on staff, often without voice, and sort of that being a very obvious issue across museums.
She'll also tell us why she decided this month to come back to MOCAD. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're at a point in the year when the explosions of 2020 are giving way to some fresh starts. At the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, a curator who left amid a wrenching conversation about equity has rejoined the staff. Jova Lin was first appointed to an endowed curator position at MOCAD in December 2019. As you may have heard, she was one of several curators, all people of color, who were recruited for the position and who made early exits. Now, MOCAD has been through a leadership change, and Jova Lin is back. A graduate of Cranbrook who's shown work in Kingston, Jamaica, Berlin, and Detroit, she joins us now. Jova Lin, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. Nice to talk to you.
Can we just maybe dial back the clock a little bit? And I wonder if you would tell me about what your hopes were when you first got recruited to work at MOCAD and what the opportunity meant to you.
Well, I first joined MOCAD as a curatorial fellow. You know, I had all this background in museum life, but was coming from more of a public programming and education background. So I was just really excited to get my hands in the curatorial role, more so for exhibitions. Coincidentally enough, I arrived at a time when there was no curator. You know, I was hopeful and I wanted to be a part of what MOCAD was doing. But at the same time, it was a little overwhelming. So I was kind of thrown into the deep end pretty quickly and pretty early on, and had to take on a lot in a very short amount of time because there was nobody who could really do that work there.
Yeah.
And so from the beginning, you know, museum life is not, it's still a laborious role, right? And
yeah.
So I think there's a lot of overwork, a lot of inequity in pay, a lot of silencing that happened. And I was like, you know, I'm here to have this experience. I really want to just keep going. I felt like a part of my goal was to really try to interact with local artists, specifically marginalized artists. So making an effort to uplift the craft of artists who I really like respected and who were working kind of in the margins here in Detroit.
For those who don't know, MOCAD is a non-collecting museum, and it's most of its work has to do with supporting all kinds of contemporary artists, which means that the people who are acting as curators are having to build and maintain those relationships all the time, figure out money for exhibitions, and actually making the exhibitions happen. And all this was going on at a time when Detroit's position in the art world carried a pretty high premium. You've worked at other institutions in New York and San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask how, when you came in, how did MOCAD stack up?
Totally different. You know, YVCA is non-collecting and Museum of the Moving Image is collecting.
Those are the two places that you worked. YVCA is the Yerba Buena Contemporary Art Museum in San Francisco.
Correct. Yeah. And those are also larger institutions. I think each institution has around between 70 and 200 people on staff. MOCAD has 22 staff people full time. And both of those institutions are endowed and MOCAD is not. Coming to MOCAD, it was less about how it stacked against those institutions and more about being sort of hands-on in a way that I wasn't at those institutions. With such a small staff, curatorial, when I arrived, was about 4 or 5 people, big department. And so it's awesome in the sense that you get to work very closely with artists and have a lot of agency, and challenging in the sense that because the endowment isn't there, it's very easy to become overworked very quickly.
Yeah. Your professional career has also coincided with this period in which all art institutions all across the United States have been forced into a reckoning with how they have treated people of color as artists,
yep,
as visitors, as donors, and also as employees. And I mean, this has been really rough. Top spots like the Whitney Museum and MoMA in New York have had really difficult conversations that have exposed that even the best in this industry are not doing a great job. So, mm-hmm. I mean, what were your expectations for how, you know, as a Black woman, you'd be interacting at MOCAD?
You know, I thought that because it was smaller, my experience would actually be different, but it was in many ways, and also the same in many ways. You know, that sort of inequity that permeates the entire art world was still there. Being in a predominantly Black city, I feel very, and have always felt very supported by artists and by the community and very seen. But I think when it came to institutional life itself, there was an erasure of the work I was doing and of my experience. And I quickly became exploited. I think that there's this idea that if somebody is in the arts, or if somebody is as an artist or an arts professional, that museums are there to sort of highlight their work. So it's like, okay, you can have a show with us and this is going to be a stepping stone in your career, right? Mm-hmm. But the challenge is then the standard labor practices aren't met because you're always trying to open a door for somebody else or take it as, this is something I'll add to my resume. It's okay that I'm being treated unfairly because in the long run, it's going to help me. And I think what we're seeing in places like the Whitney and the Met is like this incredible contradiction where a lot of funders, patrons, et cetera, want to support the museum to make it accessible to the public. And at the same time, the same public that they're trying to serve, which includes marginalized persons, is also the group of people who they're oppressing at the museum. And so I think the sort of coinciding realities of COVID-19, of Black Lives Matter, sort of enabled this conversation regarding labor to really be exposed in a way that I don't think it had before, and really sort of challenge the way people think about equity, and specifically regarding payment and the sort of usurping of the energy and time of staff of color without an adequate reward or payback for that. And I mean that literally in the amount that folks are getting paid, but also in the amount of resources that folks have access to who are doing this work, often being the only person of color on staff, often without voice, and sort of that being a very obvious issue across museums.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today to Jova Lynn, Senior Curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. Would you be comfortable sharing some experiences with us that sort of showed you, you know, how things were going to be there?
I can share one experience that I had, which is I was putting together a public program series that was actually the brainchild of Scott Campbell, who's a brilliant artist and curator. Came up with this public program called The Intersection. And I pitched to an artist whose name is Colleen Smith. She's a video artist, Black woman, who centers stories from African American life, but within an Afrofuturist context, specifically looking at birds. And something that's interesting about her work is she works with crows, and the plural of crow is a murder.
A murder of crows, right.
Yeah, a murder of crows. And so she was looking at the murders that have happened to Black folks across the nation and sort of relating it to crows. And we had this program, again, called The Intersection, which looked at science and the arts. And, you know, I was trying to get a ornithologist, scientist, someone who studies birds, to be in conversation with Colleen to sort of talk about this phenomena of like migration and murder and the plural and all these things. And unfortunately, the person who we got to speak with, Colleen, had a family death and couldn't talk. And so Colleen asked us to cancel the event. And leadership was, specifically Alicia, was very, very hesitant to cancel the program.
That's the then executive director, Alicia Borowi-Reeder. Yeah.
Yeah. So she kept telling me this was unacceptable. We had a contract. It was unacceptable. I was new to the job. And I was like, well, what should I do? I'm not going to force her to get on a plane. You know, the artist was in LA. And Alicia said, we need to send her an email telling her this is unacceptable and unprofessional. And at the time, I felt like I had no choice but to listen to her, even though my instincts told me it was wrong. I should also, for additional context, say the person who Colleen was going to speak with was also a Black woman.
The ornithologist,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so I ended up having to send Colleen an email that was one of the biggest regrets of my career. And it was essentially berating the artist, which was inappropriate. And in retrospect, I realized because it was an issue with contract, that message shouldn't have come from me. It should have come from the director.
Mm-hmm.
And Colleen, I sent the email and she wrote me back saying that there's no way in hell she could believe a Black woman would say this to another Black woman. And that I had a poor leader and a poor mentor in Alicia, and that she hoped that I could find my voice somewhere else because what I had said to her was unacceptable. So I bring that up to say, like, this was pretty early on in my time at MOCAD. And it was one of those things where I felt so powerless and so used and so frustrated and so tokenized. And that's when I started paying attention to how much we paid artists of color versus white artists, how the institution, specifically the leadership, specifically Alicia, spoke to white artists versus Black artists and people of color. And that moment sort of changed my life. I think that was the beginning. And again, it was towards the beginning. So it's interesting how this came full circle, towards the beginning of when I realized I was being tokenized, I was being used, and I was being put in compromising positions that really impacted me as a Black woman, as well as my community as a whole.
I want to return back for a moment to what we were talking about, that the reckoning is really happening across the art world. And at risk of sounding like we're letting smaller institutions off the hook, given that some of the largest and most well-resourced institutions in the United States, really not just in the art world, but all across the nonprofit sector and the business world, have not done a great job with equity issues. What does it mean that we're holding an institution of MOCAD size to this standard? Is it possible for a smaller institution to do what larger ones have not done?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, I think that the nice thing about MOCAD being small and having a leadership, and when I say leadership, I'm talking about the board. You know, MOCAD actually has a 35-person board, which is pretty large considering the size of the institution. But one thing that I have appreciated about the board in this time is that they're really listening and open to change. And I think that a part of the reckoning that's happening is, or that needs to happen, that I think larger institutions are grappling with is sort of how the board reacts to these things. For MOCAD to have a board a similar size to an institution that has a 300-person staff, as an example, for the board to be actively doing this work, it feels like it's a potential model for larger institutions. And I hope that our larger institutions start to look at what's happened with MOCAD and really think about the possibility if when faced with change of what's possible. You know, sometimes they say you have to start small to go big. And I don't necessarily know if I believe that, but I would say in this instance, museums like the Whitney, like MoMA, et cetera, have so much to learn from places like MOCAD in affecting change. What workers are asking for is so basic, right? Like hazard pay, more opportunities to get into promotions or stronger leadership roles, creating more opportunities for diverse staff membership. Like these are all things that museums should have already been striving for because again, their purpose is to serve the public. And so it doesn't seem that hard in terms of what I understand. However, I think that there's still a lot for folks to learn within that. And I hope they're paying attention.
We've alluded to this already, but the executive director, Alicia Borowy-Reeder, is no longer at MOCAD. The board separated their contract with her. What made you feel confident about coming back? The kind of culture that people have had concerns about goes beyond what one person does or allows to happen. What made you feel like you wanted to get back to this work at this particular place?
Well, so we had a couple of things going on. You have the letter from former staff, which I think was signed by over 70 people. You had a letter from community members that was signed by over 300 local artists and arts practitioners. And then there is also a letter to the board that was signed by 11 out of 14 staff members. And I think all of that combined, all of that hope, all of that honesty, all of that passion is something that I couldn't ignore in returning. If there's one thing to be said, it's that people in Detroit care about MOCAD. And I think what really made me want to be okay with going back and be excited about it is recognizing that I'm actually not alone in this. Recognizing that the community is holding MOCAD accountable and is having those hard conversations. And so community support, current staff support, and board support, just I had to give it a go.
Jova Lin is a senior curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. Jova, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. Y'all have a good day.
You too. Jova also told us that there's an awful lot coming down the pipeline at MOCAD, and she's excited about several exhibitions on the calendar. You can get information at MOCAD's website. We reached out to the former executive director of MOCAD, Alicia Borowy-Reeder, and asked if she had comments on what Jova Lin had to say. She sent us a statement that reads in part, "I think all allegations need to be substantiated. I do not wish to discount anyone's experience and often wonder if a man in leadership is held to the same standards. I gave everything," she writes, "to work at MOCAD, at times going without a paycheck. I hope to settle with MOCAD as soon as possible and I'm looking ahead as I repair the damages of this defamatory campaign. If you'd like to read Alicia Borowy Reader's entire statement, you can find it online at michiganradio.org. Before professional baseball was integrated, the Negro Leagues were home to legendary black players like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson. There are just a few Negro League ballparks left in the entire country. Hamtramck's home to one of them.
It was said in the Detroit News that it was the equivalent of the best minor league parks in the country.
Ready to hear about plans for the ballpark's revival? That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Tigers are wrapping up their season with some final road games this week. Not a great season, 2020. By contrast, it's been a great year at Hamtramck Stadium, one of a handful of Negro League ballparks left in the United States. This was where legends like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson played. Hamtramck Stadium is headed for a new future with a plan for renovation and revival. Here to give us the details is Gary Gillette. He's the founder and president of the nonprofit Friends of Historic Hamtramck Stadium. Gary, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thanks very much. I really enjoy being on your show.
Gary, will you tell us about the origin story for the stadium? What teams was it originally intended to house?
Well, Hamtramck Stadium was built in 1930, and it was originally intended to house the Negro League Detroit Stars, who were moving from the east side of Detroit. But it also, from the beginning, had many other sports and events there. It had high school baseball, high school football for Hamtramck. It had semi-pro baseball. It had soccer. They actually had some soccer matches in the 30s with teams from Europe. It had softball, both men's and women's. Of course, they called it girls back then. Joe Louis had a softball team, the great boxing champion, had a softball team that played there. It had a Japanese all-star team come through in 1935, which is a forerunner of the Tokyo Giants, who are the New York Yankees of Japan, Japanese major leagues. It had boxing, including integrated boxing matches staged by the UAW. It had church leagues. It had concerts. It had war bond rallies during World War II. It was an amazing place and, you know, thoroughly utilized by everyone who could afford to pay the rent. And in the 30s, was under private control. And starting in 1941, it was under the city control.
Now, the Hamtramck that we know today is just a very diverse place. And Hamtramck has been home to so many different people with so many different backgrounds and backstories over the years. What was Hamtramck like in the 30s and the 40s when this stadium was first in its heyday?
Well, Hamtramck was still growing from a population, I believe, around 20,000 in the 20s to its peak of over 50,000 during World War II. It was mostly Polish and Polish American, a huge number of immigrant Poles and Polish Americans with some other white ethnics from Europe, Ukrainians. It always had a small black population. There was an African-American community on the east side in a neighborhood called Ducktown that is still there. And it also had a small African-American community on the northwest side of Hamtramck. So it was a diverse place in the sense that it was welcoming to African-Americans. When the city of Detroit was still segregating its schools, Hamtramck public schools are integrated. When the city of Detroit was rigidly trying to enforce all sorts of de facto segregation, Hamtramck was pretty good. I'm not claiming it was a racial utopia, but white doctors and dentists treated black patients. There was a black dentist who had white patients. Black people could own houses, and most of the city of Detroit, black people could not buy a house. It was a pretty good place and a pretty accommodating place for African Americans. It was one of the reasons the ballpark was put there.
How would you describe the relationship between the Negro League and the white teams like the Detroit Tigers in that period?
There was essentially no relationship. The major leagues pretended from, well, late 19th century up through the 1945 when Jack Roosevelt Robinson was signed by the Brooklyn Dodgers. And then in 1946, he played in the minor leagues. In 1947, he made his debut in the major leagues. The major leagues pretended there was no barrier, there was no color line, but of course, that was a deception. And occasionally, major league players would play exhibition games against Negro League teams. This was fairly common in the teens and 20s until Commissioner Landis shut that down. After that, you had to compose a special all-star team, and only a handful of major leaguers played in them, although a lot of white minor leaguers played against Negro League teams. But that was off-season exhibitions. The black teams and the African-American community was very acutely aware when they were playing white professionals, because that was a test of how good they were. And Negro League teams and players more than held their own. They won more than half the games. The white teams, if they lost, could claim, well, we weren't really trying, just a payday for us. It doesn't really mean anything. But it was really a payday for them. They weren't proving anything, and they always had an excuse if they lost. But they did play hard in most cases, and they did lose more than half the games. So that was basically the relationship. There was no business relationship in the African-American community, and particularly the African-American newspapers. There was talk of maybe the Negro Leagues becoming minor leagues for Major League Baseball, a feeder system, or maybe a Negro League team joining the major leagues. But of course, that was their wish, and Major League Baseball had no determination they were ever going to grant that.
Right. If we were to visit Hamtramck Stadium back at the height when the Detroit Stars and the Detroit Wolves were coming through and playing, what would it have looked like? What would the experience have been like for the fans of that time?
Well, it'd be very different for today's fans who are used to these huge gold-plated ballparks, which we know and love. It would have been very different from even Tiger Stadium. It was very small. It seated about 9,000. However, that was about the size of a good minor league park back then. In 1930, when Hamtramck Stadium opened, it was said in the Detroit News that it was the equivalent of the best minor league parks in the country. So it was a good minor league park, but those things were very crude by our current standards. It was built of structural steel and wood. Almost all the seating was bleacher seating. There were chairs, a few rows of chairs for people who had the extra half dollar or so to pay for a chair, but most of it was bleacher seating. It was very intimate. The field was close to the diamond. You had essentially, you were sitting hip by hip with people, because the more tickets they sold, the more people they crowded into the bleachers.
Like any sports stadium anywhere.
Well, right. But back then they crowded them closer. Yeah. I mean, of course, their butts were skinnier too. But for the African-American community, it was sort of a celebration of their athletes and how good they could be. Baseball back then was unquestionably the national pastime, far more popular than any other sport, with the possible exception of boxing, which was huge. But boxing is not a team sport.
Right.
So on weekends and on Mondays, the Negro League teams would typically get good crowds, especially Sunday and Monday. On Sunday, African-Americans would go to church and come to the ballpark on their Sunday best, literally. On Mondays, which was typically the day off for domestic workers, they would also draw good crowds. The crowds were mostly black. It's impossible to know what the real ratio is. You see estimates of anywhere from 5% to 30% white fans at Negro League games. I say 15% is probably a good overall estimate. It would have been lower for Negro League teams during the week. There'd be fewer white fans, higher on a weekend when you had a glamorous team like the Kansas City Monarchs or the Homestead Grays playing, especially if you had a standout pitcher like Satchel Paige on the mound. That's when you would have more white fans.
For sure.
In the South, the fans were segregated. In the North, they typically weren't segregated, though in places like St. Louis, they might be.
What kind of shape is Hamtramck Stadium in today?
It's been closed off and neglected since 1997. It is awaiting restoration. We just restored the field, literally in the last month. We restored the field. The outfield, we just put a new soccer pitch on there that has striped out a soccer pitch yesterday, the Hamtramck Recreation Department. The infield, which is completely rebuilt, excavated and rebuilt using professional quality materials in terms of the clay sand mix, the top dressing, the bases, the mound and home plate and the batter's box. So we're going to give it another week for the grass and the sod to knit their roots. And then on the 29th, we're going to have a small public announcement at the home plate that the baseball diamond is ready for use. Of course, it's so late in the year, there's not going to be much activity this year there, but we're looking forward to having a full schedule of high school and vintage baseball teams and soccer and everything starting next spring.
And it sounds like you're just getting started. The Friends of the Stadium, the group that you're president of, has secured a federal grant for nearly $500,000. How are you going to spend the money?
So that $500,000 is part of the puzzle. We really need about $2.3 million to redo the grandstand. Wayne County secured $500,000 in federal funds, $400,000 the Tigers have committed, They secured another $500,000 from the National Park Service. That's the announcement you're thinking of. It's $490,000 for the National Park Service for their African American Cultural Heritage Program. And that's a key grant because it gets us closer to that $2.3 million. And we're soon to announce another $250,000 grant from a major foundation in Detroit. And that leaves us about $650,000 short of the $2.3 million we need to start redoing the grandstand next spring. We are confident we are going to have that money in hand and construction will begin next spring or early summer, as soon as the ground is suitable.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Gary Gillette about restoration efforts at historic Hamtramck Stadium, one of the few remaining Negro League stadiums in the country. Gary, what is your hope for how the park will be used by future generations?
I hope that it's a community asset like it once was. I love to see high school sports there. We want to see kids playing pickup games there. We are going to dedicate a block of time each week for community usage where kids can just come, and adults too, can just come and play, you know, baseball, they can play soccer, they can do any sport they want there because it's a community asset. There's not going to be any fence around the facility. It's going to be open to everyone. The park is open from sunup to sundown. And so we hope to have many, many events there, but mostly community usage and events where you have like a high school baseball team playing there, or you have an adult soccer recreation league playing there. We think it'll be used virtually every day from when the snow is off the ground and the mud is dries up until the snow flies in the fall.
Gary, the Negro League teams that brought the stadium to prominence, how many of those players are still with us today?
Very, very few. If you count the heyday of the Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1950, there are very few players who played in 1950 or earlier, because if you played in 1950 at the age 18, you would have been born in 32, and
right.
That means you'd be 88 now.
Right.
We have one local treasure, Ron Teasley, who is 93, and he is a Detroit native. He still lives in Detroit. He was a pioneering Black player at Northwestern High School playing baseball and basketball. He coached at Northwestern High School for more than two decades. Baseball, basketball, and golf. He's in the Wayne State Athletic Hall of Fame, still holds several baseball records at Wayne State. He served in the Navy after World War II. He played professional baseball in the Dodgers organization in 1948 and also played for the Negro League New York Cubans in 48 when they were defending world champions. He is, as I said, he's 93. He's typical of the guys who are left. There are more guys left who played baseball in the Negro American League of the 1950s, but the Negro American League of the 1950s was very much reduced in quality because almost all the really good Black players had been signed by major league teams. So the farther you go into the 50s, the lower the quality of play was in the remaining Negro League because the better players were being taken up by the major leagues. So there are more guys left who played in the 50s, but even them, most of them are in their 80s. And we just have very few left. It's sad to see them passing.
Mm. There's a player whose name probably is known to Detroit baseball fans, Norman Stearns, better known as Turkey Stearns. And I know that his name is going to live on as a part of the park. First of all, will you tell us about his career?
Turkey Stearns was a native of Nashville. He was one of those gifted athletes. He started playing professional baseball in 1920 when he would have been 19. He was born in 1901. He played 3 years for minor Negro League teams in the South, Nashville, Montgomery. He then came north to Detroit, and he became a star pretty much instantly in 1923. He played for the Detroit Stars from 23 to 31. When the original Detroit Stars folded with the original Negro National League during the Depression at the end of the 31 season, he moved on to other teams. He did come back to Detroit in 37 to play for the new edition of the Detroit Stars. He won seven Negro League home run titles. He hit for about 350, which is basically one of the highest averages you would see in any given season. His career average is around 350. It's hard to get exactly what it was. He was what they call a five-tool player. He could hit for average, hit for power. He could run the bases. He was a very fast base runner and a smart base runner. He also had excellent range in the field and had a good throwing arm. He played center field, which is a key position in the outfield. He was a five-time Negro League All-Star which doesn't sound like a lot because he had a career of 18 years, except that the Negro League All-Star Game was founded in 1933. It was called the East-West Game, the same year the Major League All-Star Game was. So for the bulk of his career, there was no All-Star Game. But after 33, when he was still on the twilight of his career, he still made five All-Star teams. We're naming the field, and the city of Hamtramck has agreed to name the field Turkey Stearns Field, but the name of the stadium will remain Hamtramck Stadium. So the name will be Turkey Stearns Field at Hamtramck Stadium.
What lit the fire under the group to name the field after Turkey Stearns?
We really wanted to see more recognition for him. Turkey Stearns is a Hall of Famer. He's in the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. But he was put there in 2000, 21 years after his death. And like he asked me, 25 years after he should have been elected. They didn't start putting Negro Leaguers in the Hall of Fame until the early 70s. He was put in very late and sadly after his death, as most of them were. We're trying to get more recognition. Even though he was a Nashville native, he was a Detroiter. He came to Detroit in 23. He played for the Stars. He made his home here in the offseason. He worked 27 years at the Ford Rouge plant. He was a UAW member from the time the UAW organized Ford in 1941. He raised a family on the northwest side of Detroit. He is as Detroit as they come, except for not being born here. He was an admirable man. He was not a show-off or an egotist. He was very quiet. He let his playing speak for itself. Oddly, amongst ball players back then, not just black ball players, white ball players drank like fish most of the time. He did not drink and he did not carouse. So on a typical evening after the game, he would go home, or he would go, like if they were out of town, he might go for a walk. There's a beautiful story Ron Teasley tells when Ron was this is in 1945, when Turkey and Ron were playing for the Toledo Cubs in a minor Negro League. Turkey would have been 44 and Ron would have been 18. And Turkey took Ron on a tour of New Orleans, a walking tour after a game down there, and was mentoring this young ball player rather than going out to the clubs in New Orleans, which would have been fabulous to go out and listen to jazz music and carouse with the others. But he never did that. He was a really admirable ball player, husband, father, and citizen of Detroit.
For people who've never seen the park before, this is located in Veterans Memorial Park in Hamtramck. And we should say there's an online symposium that's happening this Thursday on the Negro Leagues, and there'll be all kinds of presentations, both from the county and experts and players. And I understand you've organized a free self-driving tour of the park for Thursday afternoon. Can you talk about how people will experience it, like what it'd be like driving through and what you've arranged to help interpret the place?
Sure. We're having an online symposium. I just want to mention it's free. There's no registration. You can connect via Zoom until the Detroit Historical Museum, which is hosting this, until their Zoom account is full. And then you can watch on Facebook Live. And in the afternoon, I'm leading what I call a do-it-yourself driving tour. We're going to drive to more than a half dozen sites associated with the Negro Leagues in Detroit. You drive in your own car if you want to get out of your car at the site. You wear a mask and socially distance. I will give a talk at each site. After the tour, there will be MP3 files for each site posted on the web, so you can go to any site at any time and get your own tour. Thursday, it starts at 1 o'clock at Detroit Historical Museum and ends at 5:30 at the Church of the Messiah on Grand Boulevard near the Belle Isle Bridge. However, anyone can join the tour at any point and leave at any point, and they just drive themselves. We're posting maps on the web for every site, so you can go directly to that site or you can follow the tour. The tour will be up there afterwards.
Gary Gillette is the founder and president of the Friends of Historic Hamtramck Stadium. Gary, thank you so much for talking to us about this, and congratulations on the renovation efforts.
Thanks so much, April. It's great to be on your show.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.